seminar, and really it's I think it's appropriate to perhaps present it in Crash in the sense that because it deals with so many disciplinary aspects, I suppose by way of background I should say that I am an urban planner, and for 20 years or so I've been teaching and writing about urban planning, mainly finding fault with it, I should add. And I've always had sensibilities about wider notions of place and cities and identity, but have found it very difficult to bring those into my traditional discipline and disciplinary area. And about 10, 12 years ago, I decided to pursue a master's degree in film as a way of giving me that boost to start talking about film issues in a way which will bore the pants off friends now if you're ever in the same room or dare go to the cinema together. I keep on saying, look at the direction there, look at the lighting, get this nudge, and saying, shut up and enjoy the film. But it was an obvious way to try and bring together my interest in cities, in planning, and planning in bringing about urban change, or managing it, alongside a notion about how places appear on screen, places that we might recognise from films or appear to recognise, which are sometimes constructs, which are not accurate, but nevertheless perhaps raise certain sensibilities and emotions in us when we recognise places on the screen. Sometimes as a backdrop, but we immediately tend to look at the backdrop as much as the figures in the foreground. And I think these issues play on people's emotions. This is what I'm playing around with, essentially. The idea that we are inspired, perhaps, or we're influenced by how we see places on screen, which might carry over into our attitudes for the real world and our attitudes towards change that might be enacted in the real world. So taking emotional responses from perhaps fiction, narrative, sometimes documentary and other genres, and then carrying that over to think about how change has occurred around us and what we feel about that change. And it, for some people, it will go so far as to influence them into acting about resisting development, resisting change, or calling for something to be protected. And I really think, I suppose, my research and work over the last 5 or 6 years has been about these disciplinary divides and trying to bridge them, because I feel that new knowledge, new innovation, new ideas come about from the bridge between those disciplines, not just within the disciplines. Wouldn't life be boring if we just stayed within our disciplinary environments, our comfort zones? The innovation for disciplines comes from the bridge, the links that we make between one discipline and another. And it's a scary world, because it challenges us about use of different concepts, different methodologies, which are not easy to pigeonhole in one discipline or another. I'm sure you're experiencing this already. I still am to some extent. So that's, if you like, my context. That's the background of where I'm coming from, and which shaped this book, which is essentially an attempt to bridge urban planning with film, with photography, with a cultural turn. And you can judge whether it's successful or not as well. My cue came from this, Calvino's Invisible Cities book from 1970s, I should say, which says, the eye does not see things, but images of things that mean other things. In other words, we look at something and actually maybe we see something else. We read something else in it, not just from the observable, but something more meaningful from it. And that has always interested me. As a child growing up in the 1960s and 1970s, I remember going to Cardiff, my nearest city, and being absolutely amazed by the city, by the number of people there, by the sorts of buildings, terraces of houses and shops that went on for as the eye could see, a castle that looked positively medieval, but actually was less than 100 years old. The strange fact that although it was certainly in Wales, it had all Scottish street names, and I couldn't understand that. And also, of course, at that time, a lot of the city being swept away by forces of planning, by development, by high-rise buildings, by new urban motorways and dual carriageways being constructed. I remember going with my parents at the time, and basically the city centre was a constant building site. This was the station that we used probably at this time, about 1970, 71, Queen Street Station, which opened up into the shopping mall area. And you can see the sort of high-rise buildings, office buildings that were going on at that time, and being fascinated by it. And people say to me today, oh, you're fascinated by planning. You talk non-stop about planning. And I say, actually, I'm more interested in places. I'm more interested in the history of places, the geography of places, about the representation of places. And planning is just merely a means, one of the means that we use for intervention and to manage all the conflicting interests that you find in the city and other places. But those interests about the place, coupled with the interest of planning, has really carried on with me. And the thing that struck me at the time when we used to go to places like Cardiff was about what was different compared to back home. And the biggest difference I noticed was that all their buses were orange. And that was fantastic, especially to a six-year-old. It was absolutely amazing, because back home, all the buses were dreary red double-deckers that you just didn't think about, because you saw them all the time. But these were orange buses. I remember the tagline that the company used to use, which was pick an orange. A really good slogan, get on a bus. So they were really old buses, as you can see. But nevertheless, they were distinctive. And so going to Cardiff, as well as trying to cope with the building works, the change in city, as you can see around you, navigating your way through streets that basically disappeared from one week to the next, the thing that struck me about going to Cardiff was the transport, was this mobility aspect, was the orange buses. Conversely, going to other places around for day trips, like to Bristol or Bath or Weston-super-Mare, nearby places, what struck me about knowing that I was in these other places as a six-year-old was that all their buses were green. And so I knew that I was in a totally different place. I didn't really have any sense of space, perhaps, in the sense of how long we travelled or the number of kilometres we journeyed. But nevertheless, I knew we were in a different place because perhaps the buildings looked very different. Essentially, the buses were very different as well and had different colours. And if you think about it, that's quite interesting, because we can think of how issues like transport, different types of mobility, and how they're represented, the different designs, the different liveries, create some sense of identity for specific places. Not just about Cardiff, not just about Bristol, but you could think of the Routemaster bus representing London. You could think of yellow cabs in relation to New York. You could think of the Paris Metro. You could think of tram cars in San Francisco. You could think of rickshaws in India. And you can attach a sense of place identity with those different types of transport. Not exclusively, of course, you'll find them in other places as well. But the fact is that they are a signature, they are a symbol, maybe an icon in the case of something like a Routemaster bus. And even though some of them have disappeared and some of the designs have changed, what is interesting is that they're still used in cultural references, they're still used in media, they're still used in films and television programs. You notice any depiction on television of London will have a red Routemaster bus going along somewhere on the screen, even though Routemaster buses disappeared from the streets 10 years ago or less. And that's interesting, because there's something there that's a crossover between these sorts of things and place identity to tell audiences this is the place that we're talking about at this point in time. Red Routemaster bus equals London. There are things like checker taxis. There's the classic designs of yellow cabs in New York. I remember going to New York for the first time 15 years ago and expecting to see all these checker taxis all around the place. And of course, they don't exist anymore, except in museums. They are just basically Ford standard taxi cabs. They're not checker cabs, the iconic design from the checker taxi company. But I thought that New York was full of these on the basis they've been depicted in so many television programs and in so many films like Taxi Driver. And I thought I was going to see one. I was going to use one as well. I was really disappointed, actually, that I didn't see one. And, of course, it comes as no surprise that as a 6 or 7 year old at this time, television and film played an increasingly important part of my life in my leisure time. It's a symptom of the 1960s, 1970s, the onset of television. You know, parents just plonk the kid in front of the TV. And I was fascinated as well by the places that I saw on screen. This is not me, as you might guess. This is the actor Trevor Eve playing a character called Shoestring in a BBC detective programme from 1978, 1979, something like that. It's one of the programmes I remember because it was filmed in Bristol. And so I knew Bristol. And so I recognised the places on screen, even though it was a fictional drama, detective series, using real places, realistic places, obviously, to represent and to base the storylines as a backdrop, but sometimes quite prominently as well. And what's interesting is if you look at these historic depictions of places on screen over time, then, of course, these films are not meant to be historic portrayals of particular places, but they become historic portrayals of places. So if you look at Shoestring today, if you dig out a DVD, if you're that minded, you will look at Bristol as it was depicted 35 years ago and go, wow, look how much Bristol has changed. Which is not the point of the detective series when it was aired, of course. That's not the point. But it awakens something in you, a reminiscent, perhaps, sense of nostalgia, a sense of questioning how much the urban backdrop has changed, how much places change beyond all recognition in some cases as well. So there's issue there about what film does over time, even documentary film. But when you view it as an archival film, it also creates a sense of nostalgia and difference that you immediately recognize. Because film obviously creates this immediate sense of change in your environment when you see places represented on screen. Sometimes, as I say, accurately, sometimes not. So let's switch to planning for the moment, and my traditional discipline, you could say. And in relation to everything I've just said about those cultural references, when you park it in relation to urban planning, all that seems very archaic. It seems as though it's got nothing to do with it whatsoever. Why? Because planning is traditionally concerned with strategies and policies, very dry. It concerns individual plots of land. It concerns deciding whether to give permission for change and new development or change in use of land, or obviously public consternation and argumentation sometimes about the different uses to which land could be put, issues of property and rights and freedom. And so when you talk about issues of place and identity and nostalgia and change, in relation to the planning project, the modern planning project, then these can seem somewhat isolated examples. But I think there is a crossover. Planning has changed. There's no such thing as a singular planning system. It is made up of lots of different elements. And it has changed over considerable periods of time as well. It has morphed between different political purposes every decade for the last 100 years, not just in the UK, but in many countries that have had a form of land use regulatory process. It is a subject of political interference and political control. And it's doing that now, actually, under the coalition government, as we have another reform of planning systems going on. The reason I think it's timely to start thinking and merging issues of place, identity, nostalgia, conservation issues, perception of places, perceptions of the urban, with the hard reality of the mechanistic and bureaucratic exercise of the planning system, is that things are going on, which means there needs to be a bridge. And my contention is that there's more public appetite to discuss places and discuss change and maybe be resistant to change. There's a political move to give the public and others a greater voice in the planning system, not just rely on professional experts who have had their time and maybe created worse places rather than better places over periods of time as well. So there's this enhanced potential for more public involvement. And their cue, the public's view, might not be strategies and laws and documents, the very terminology and apparatus of the planners. Their cues will come from their everyday experiences of living and working and travelling around the urban arena. And that will be based on language which will be unfamiliar to professional planners, about associated with place, not with planning. Okay. So this could be, if you like, an interesting angle, that if there's more public involvement and public expressed desires about change or resistant to change, they will not do it in the syntax of the professional community. They will do it in the syntax that they recognize, and they might be influenced to some extent by other things. It might be education, intellect, culture, and of course media. And I think there's something to be learned from the planning profession, and those of us in planning academia, to be sensitive to what might happen, not saying it will happen, what might happen. There's a second element, which is forms of globalization. I mentioned about checker cabs in New York being replaced by Ford, essentially. That old buses representative of particular cities, perhaps you could find only in some places, not others, being withdrawn and replaced with something very generic. You know, it's a form of globalization in a sense. And if you think about places, and certainly high streets and central areas of urban places, they start to look a bit like identical cities. They have the same chain stores, they have the same coffee shops, the same apparatus you'd expect to find anywhere. And you might be disappointed, perhaps some people would be disappointed, that you don't find enough of these, or Starbucks on every corner. But maybe there will come a time when people will find more resistance to that, will look, in other words, for authenticity, for some sort of identity associated with particular places as influencer, rather than the same chain stores, the same types of mobility that they can find anywhere else. And that's what drives tourism, and that's what drives an appetite for travelling, as much as anything else, to discover new things. So maybe in an urban context, this notion of place and identity is almost a counter to issues of globalization and increasing globalization in the city. You can see the sorts of things I'm playing around with in my mind. And then the third element is about modernity and the modern planning project, the modern city. We've been used to that now for the best part of 80, 90 years or so. Has two elements to it, and that is we rush headlong into the future. We're excited about technology. It used to be the case that the state was very interested in technology. That's not so much these days in the UK, but individuals are constantly interested in technology and how this changes our lives, behaviour, where we work, how we work, and so on. But it has two prongs. It is this rush towards the future and being excited about new developments, but there's a component which makes us glance back at what we're losing in the process. Okay? So embrace the future, but also think about where we come from and what are we losing in that process by this constant rush forward into a technological and very uncertain future as well, which will change things, and that's what we're uncertain about. So as we strive for faster, better improvements, you name it, there will be an element which will sneakily look backwards about where we come from. Maybe with rose-tinted spectacles on about what we lose in this process while simultaneously looking forward. And so planning is no longer a component of just the modern modernity. It's rather suspended. It was all about, in the period when it was created, in this modern guise through the 30s through to the 60s and 70s, it was all about that white heat of technology. Was about technological advancement. It was a creating utopia, which of course were never realized in the way that people expected. But it was forward thinking, it was proactive, it was visionary. And once people saw what was being provided, then dreams were shattered. And it's become, if you like, planning has become a tool as much of protecting the past and looking at that backward glance and thinking about conservation and thinking about protection and being reactive, as it is about forward thinking and being proactive. Planning is split, is caught between this desire to provide for the future while also protecting the past. So it's no longer just about the modern project of forward thinking. It actually does two things, almost contradictory things, at the same time. And no wonder then you get the public and others caught in between pressures for pressure of people wanting more and people trying to resist it as well. And it's the same process we use to try and manage that contradiction in the two processes. All this is problematic because if you read the literature, and this is where the difficulty of the multidisciplinary issue comes in, then there are lots of geographers and others around who will say, well, it's impossible. It's impossible for planets to embrace notions of place and space. It's not what they do. It's not their language. You know, you can't do it. Space can't be fixed. Doreen Massey, the Four Space book, for example, says that, you know, space has the product of interrelations. It's very fluid. Can't be pinned down. Can't be fixed. It is multiple as well. And planners come along, they try and fix it. Stop the world a moment, just to deal with it. And then once we deal with it, we can start it on its course again, and you can carry on. And of course, you can't do it. So planners try to fix space, fix problems, as though they were rigid and they were bounded. Bounded by boundaries, boundary up to the city of, at the edge of the city of Cambridge, for example, and you can't do anything beyond that, because that's someone else's responsibility. And that's how planners look at space, which is not, of course, how everyone else looks at space, because they can't see this administrative line on the map. So planning is caught between trying to control chaos, trying to pin it down in order to deal with change, whereas others, like Massey and others, say it's impossible to do that. Leonie Sandercock, in her book Mongrel Cities, and previously Cosmopolis, talked about this a lot, but from the perspective of being a planner, and actually said that if you look at traditional planet histories, how the planners see the world and what's happened, and of course they will always view the world according to their take and what they've done for the world and how they've created an attempt for improvement. She said that lots been lost. A lot has been lost in that process of saying that's happened because of this bit of legislation. And that's not really how people see the world or operate in the world or think of the world. She says that a lot has been lost in the spaces between. What's been lost in the stories about how people see these places, a bit like my description of being brought up in Cardiff, I suppose, are my influences. That sort of perception, those sorts of influences have been lost from the planning literature, but from concepts as well. They've seen it in terms of regulatory politics rather than actual places and spaces, which mean something for people. So that bridge is not an easy one to make. I acknowledge that. And there are people who would say that it can't be done. But I think film and photography could be a way of unlocking it, could be a way of assisting. I'm not saying it is the bridge, it's just a different way of looking at the bridge. The camera lens is literally a lens to look at the world and to look at change. And it gives us this additional perspective which perhaps other realms of the social sciences especially can't provide us with. It looks at intervention, it looks at urban change, it looks at that fluidity in very obvious ways, as film has been made over the decades and has depicted. So it's an alternative perspective that you might not get, say, from the planning syntax or the planner's viewpoint. It's about looking at people's perceptions and emotions of places that maybe the planners just can't connect with or feel remote from or don't understand in some way. But it might be the sort of language that members of the public themselves and individuals use on a daily basis. And it offers this way to represent and communicate different perspectives, and they're not often accurate. They're based on fiction. Film is sometimes narrative, sometimes a construct. Places masquerade as other places in location filming. And so people expect to see things that don't actually exist. But it influences, and that's the important point, it influences how people think about places as well. And Massey says that, you know, like photography, any other media, it's just another way, like maps, it's just another way of looking at the world. But if people are using it as a cue to feel about something about change in their built environment, then maybe it's time that others, whether that's the planning profession, planning academics and so on, start to think about it. The cultural turn, issues about using art, literature, film, poetry, have been used quite a lot in other social sciences, geography, architecture, anthropology, but it's not come home to roost in planning yet. And so this is my take, that it's about time the planning does look at that. As he says, that if space is a story so far, then place is a collection of those stories. I mean, it's that fluid. And those collections of stories might be influenced by film, photography, and stories and narratives as much as anything else. But if you read, sorry to dip into Lefebvre this time of day, but if you read sort of Lefebvre, then basically there's a claim that don't talk nonsense. Planners, architects, and others can't discuss these issues about space and change in space because that's not what they're there to do. They are issues about representation of spaces and spaces of representation. And the public, if you like, and the day-to-day existence is on one side, and the planners are on the other side trying to fix everything. And that's where the obvious gap is, and that's where the obvious need to have a better way of understanding. And if you look at the way that the urban has been depicted in film, it's always been there. You know, 120 years almost of film's existence, moving image existence. One of the very first moving pictures was the Lumiere brothers, a film of workers leaving a factory in Lyon by 1893, 1894, and of course it was an urban setting, 2-minute film or less, showing mobility, and that was the whole point of a moving picture, to demonstrate crowds, to demonstrate the urban population at the end of their shift at the factory. But it's always been used, and it's always a point of fascination of what the city is. This is a still from Vertov's Man with a Movie Camera from 1929, filmed in Moscow and Gorky. Fascinating hour-long film, about 24 hours in the life of the city. Realist in nature, and also employing lots of camera trickery in the process to depict back to audiences about the urban condition, about the sort of living in the city, and routines within the city as well. You could think about more narrative constructs, you probably recognize this, still from Fritz Lang's Metropolis, about what the city could become in terms of an urban threat, or authoritarian control, for that matter. Mm-hmm. Lots of views about the city of the future, and what that might mean in terms of good and bad, for that matter. And of course, you can look at different films in history and immediately recognize places, and immediately have notions about what that means. Know what this is? This is the Third Man. So there's the old wheel in Vienna, and a noir film. But essentially, you know, people might recognize it in terms of the wheel is still there, about this depicted parts of Vienna, maybe in post-war period, but also, of course, what it is today as well. And change, of course, has been part of the filmic narrative as well. It's been used deliberately. This is a quick still from the Ealing comedy Passport to Pimlico, about, and the whole narrative there is what to do with the derelict bomb site and differences in the community between whether it should be for the local kids as a swimming pool, or should it be for houses and shops and more commercial elements. You know, same arguments that we have in today about different plots of land as well and what the community does to do it. And, you know, filmed in Pimlico, actually it's not, it's filmed in Lambeth, near Lambeth Palace, not on the, on the south side of the Thames, not on the north side. But it's interesting that this is the film point itself here, about change and what the post-war era is offering us in the spirit of utopia as well. Mrs. Wilberforce's house in The Lady Killers, another Ealing comedy, 1955, set above Gasworks Tunnel, just out of King's Cross, and it's actually a film set. And believe it or not, there are several websites devoted to trying to locate all the scenes and location settings for The Lady Killers today, if you're that much of an anorak, and trying to track them down and visit them today if you want to. And although the tunnel is still there and the line is still there, so I said that's a film set. The front of the house is actually filmed towards St. Pancras, it's Argyle Street. So, you know, again, a different era, a different sort of urban depiction as well. You probably recognise this one. Is that what Turin is, really? The Italian Job from 1969. Michael Caine and colleagues causing havoc with a dare and robbery in the middle of Turin, but the city is depicted quite a lot there. And some of my students went on a field trip to Turin last week, and that was the first thing they tried to find, actually, when they arrived. They didn't want to enjoy the culture of the city as it's been offered today. They were trying to track down the film locations, nothing to do with me, honestly. They were trying to track down the film locations of where the Italian Job was filmed. And that's how, that's an important emotional response of people who were born who were in their mid-20s, late-20s, dealing with a film perspective from 42 years ago, and how it plays that influence on today's minds as well. If you look at the kitchen sink dramas from the 1960s as well, where the backcloth is of urban, and intentionally so as well, in lots of films, like at the top, Room at the Top, or at the bottom, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. The industrial backdrop is used to good effect. The characters are deliberately situated in quite uncompromising environments, in fairly nasty areas, some post-industrial areas, still suffering the legacy of that industrial era with large chimneys. The character at the top saying, look at those chimneys, that's all brass, that's all money, that's what we should be striving for. That's the city of the future and my dream of the future. Whereas in the bottom film, and Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, then essentially the characters have a romantic liaison or have an affair against the backdrop of the city where they can't carry on that affair for fear of being recognised. So they are brought up above on a location of, on a hill out of that maelstrom in order to escape and to have the love affair, which is part of an escape as well. Deliberately, there's a actual a filmic technique for this, and it's not very advanced or scientific at all. It's called that shot of that hit of that town from that hill, and that's a proper filmic technique. But if you look at lots of the kitchen sink dramas at this time, all the characters are brought up out of the industrial city to realise their dreams, and somehow the industrial city is holding them back in some ways. So interesting that not so much of a backcloth here, but actually played a part of the characters and the alienation of characters as well. And of course, there have been other films over time which have played around with these notions of what planners are providing for us. If you just look closely at what the roundabout and the cars are doing, you realise what I mean. This is from Jacques Tati's film, Playtime, from 1967, which is a fantastic tongue-in-cheek film about what the 60s had become in terms of modernity, in terms of prioritising traffic over perhaps pedestrianised areas, of the provision of large plate glass offices, or are they shops, or are they homes, and that's the point. The opening scene is a stark corridor with people walking along with footsteps, and you can't tell if it's a hospital or it's an airport, and so on, and that's his point, really, that this is the architecture of the time and the paradigm of the time, and it's creating this environment. What's great about the film is this is Paris at some uncertain point in the near future, and the only hint of places like Montmartre or the Eiffel Tower or the Arc de Triomphe is when people open the plate glass doors and suddenly there's a reflection somewhere there of something in backdrop, but you never see the buildings themselves, and all the adverts in the travel agents are basically come to Athens and it's a tower block, come to London and it's a tower block, and so on. So it's a nice play on it. It's a long, it's a long film, really. It's too long, but it works, if you like, to have a sense of having to go. The adopted wisdom of the time. Probably recognise this as well. Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange, 1971. And although most of the film was filmed in Thamesmead, a new town on the south side of the Thames, in southeast Thames, this actually was filmed in an underpass under Wandsworth Roundabout in southwest London, and if you just happen to walk past this, you'll see lots of people taking photographs and reenacting this. Not completely, You know, no one is there, well, hopefully not, it is South London, but nobody's sort of standing over people and beating up and killing tramps, but essentially you've got people having their photographs taken in something as sexy as a concrete underpass under a motorway. And that's from 1971, and it has this strange effect on people as well. Blade Runner, the vision of the future, almost post-apocalyptical, in nature, and thinking about what might happen there, and places which masquerade as other places. This is Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket, which is looking at the ravages of the Vietnam War. This is actually in Beckton in South London, where the film was made. And it loses all sense of narrative when you realize actually where it was filmed or not. And likewise, there are lots of websites set up for Amelie, which is Paris, and people go into Paris and have their photograph taken in exactly the same locations as some of the films set up as well. And there is this. You might think it's, you know, it's just the oddball or certain people who will do these homages in certain parts of the city to things that they've seen on screen. But I think it plays around with emotions. You might recognize that in Cardiff Bay, was a very BBC, successful BBC TV series called Torchwood. If you go to Cardiff Bay today, there are people calling for it to be returned to its natural Cardiff Bay home, rather than be filmed on location in the United States where the current series is. So an interesting crossover, again, where people see a place on screen, they recognize it, and immediately they either have their photographs taken around it, or actually they want the door to Torchwood, which is non-existent really, reinserted in the physical fabric of the environment as well. Crazy, maybe the Welsh for you, but also, you know, look at the number of notes and other things left here as well. I got this from The Guardian the other day, where someone has really spent a worthwhile period of time cataloguing the locations of 2,000 movies on Google Maps. There for everyone to see. And again, this crossover between maybe not just documentary but narrative films and exactly where you can find where they were filmed. Too much information, a bit over the top? Yes, it is probably. But clearly people, you know, these things aren't quite popular with people, and they do carry it on. You could also think in terms of our issues about nostalgia, not just about the fictional places we see on screen there, but also our passion to remember the past. Remember the past perhaps from a filmic image or still, or photograph, old photograph, but also actually what actually occurred in history as well. You know, London is absolutely littered with blue plaques everywhere. You can't move the blue plaques because we want to record what or happened at that particular site at a certain historic point in time. Who lived there, who was born there, what happened there. And it awakens certain sensibilities in us as well, about what was, how it happened as well. Not just about certain things, but even more historic things, about sometimes very difficult to imagine going back sort of 600 and odd years to try and certain remember characters other than through certain stage entertainments, perhaps, or even more recent events, and what that constitutes as well. So these, you know, we have a tendency to be nostalgic. We want to be remember. Urban memorials is a very emergent, interesting topic in the field of urbanism and cultural geography, certainly. We are filled with these sorts of things. And so maybe it's this issue about what the urban means for us today. You know, is it parking lots? Is it bits of housing that we don't really want to see next to iconic architecture in some way? Is it the dead end of cities that we try and renovate and improve? And there's character associated with these places and identity, but they've been lost under the clamor for redevelopment and change. And so maybe this is why people are thinking backwards, that they want to cling on to something that perhaps they think they're losing by the onset of rapid change and relentless change as well. So, this onset of nostalgia and reminiscence, and given that we have an ageing society in the UK, that basically one in four people will be over 60 in 20 years' time, and I'll be in that crowd as well, maybe there'll be a propensity for more nostalgia as you get older as well. So maybe this is something that will increase, who knows? Because they say that you get more nostalgic the older that you get. But
it seems to be crossing over between this, what you can see, what you can identify with, what you're influenced by, into physical realms. And Berman has suggested that this modernity has these two things, developing forward, but also, I said, reacting against that and clinging on to something as well. And it's no surprise then that urban planning, the very activity that tries to look in both directions simultaneously, is something that the public find quite alienating or are against. If we look at things like the Barbican, then it awakens certain sensitivities. The Barbican, the BBC asked for the most, the worst and best 20th century building in Britain in a poll, and the Barbican came top in both categories. And that gives an idea, if you like, of this contradiction that people have between the forward and the backward. Trellick Tower, so many urban myths of Erna Goldfinger's tower in West London about what this represents and the fact that Goldfinger, the architect, threw himself off the top of it because he was so depressed by public reaction to it. It's a myth. Of course he didn't. But nevertheless, it's perpetuated as a way of saying we don't want this style of architecture. We don't want these sorts of developments. No surprise, perhaps, is the planning, geography, and architectural communities, professional sets, younger sets, will think this is an absolute dream. And then you have things like in Gateshead, Tyneside, you have the car park, the Trinity Street car park, which is a grade two listed building, and which appeared in quite a well-known film called Get Carter in 1971, Mike Hodges' film. And in that film, you might know, there's a scene where Michael Caine meets one of his opponents in the city, gang warfare, and throws him from the top of Trinity Street car park. And that's become an iconic moment in the film, but it's created an iconic moment in the environment of Tyneside as well. It wasn't listed because of its film status, it was listed because of its engineering, but it was never used, and in fact the cafe at the top was never a success, as you can imagine. Neither was the car park, for that matter, but fantastic views over the city, that's why it was filmed as a location. There are Get Carter tours. There are Get Carter reenactment societies, believe it or not, where people, you know, reenact scenes, not throw people off the top of the building, but reenact scenes around that car park as well. It becomes a fixed part of the city. The city council and the Gateshead can't stand it because it's redolent of something that was a failure of modern planning project. But to people who have see maybe an absence of iconic buildings in Gateshead, it's certainly something that they want to protect it. It's and gone. So it's gone. It was demolished in 2010, I regret to say, despite its listing on the behest of the city fathers who basically wanted, didn't want this as the symbol of Gateshead, of course, its starring role. And of course, it's interesting that filmmakers have started to take this as well. We've moved a lot away from the sorts of depictions of film about, you know, something from the past or a change in city, to now where filmmakers deliberately take these two dimensions of forward thinking and nostalgia and put them into one as the narrative of the film. Terence Davis's 2008 film of Time in the City, fantastic film about a change in Liverpool, using Super 8 home movies of people to depict that change from the 30s up to present day, or up to the 70s, 80s anyway. And, you know, it's a love song and an eulogy in the sense that it plays around with notions of emotion and nostalgia, and personally Terence Davis's nostalgia for the city of his birth as well. And basically not just what happened to the city in terms of the ravages of a post-industrial age, but rather what the architects and planners did to his city in the name of progress in the 50s and 60s as well. And this has become, you know, quite a successful film, cinematic release, shown quite a lot in art houses and other places, because it's the public certainly recognise it. Saint-Étienne, pop band, making films increasingly with Paul Kelly, Finisterre, 24 Hours in the Life of London, from 2003, and followed it by another film, What Have You Done Today, Mervyn Day, which is set in the Lower Lee Valley on the Olympic site, just after the announcement of the Olympics, before it had been changed. And these also constitute notions about change and liminal spaces. It's
is what Andrew Higson calls it, things that you don't know, you take for granted, that you try and make sense of. And these filmmakers and people like Patrick Keeler and Paul Kelly are trying to look at the places that we take for granted, and somehow they are the familiar and cherished scenes that perhaps we feel a sense of emotion towards. Patrick Keeler's latest film, Romsden in Ruins, more about the Oxfordshire countryside, perhaps, than the urban films of London and Robinson Space, which he did previously. But psychogeography, playing around with the issues that we expect to see, we recognise, and the things that we don't recognise, and using film as a prompt to people to awaken it. So realise time is going on. So what we have left in our urban scenery are things which perhaps are iconic, or they base, or they sublime. We have a mixture, we have a palimpsest of different styles of intervention and layering of city, different styles of architecture, which have constituted themselves over long periods of time. But is this really sublime? Is this the sort of city that people want? There have also been, you know, moments in time, I should say, because this is in the book, if you'd like to buy it, that filmmakers have deliberately used humour, have used architecture and propaganda, basically to instill a sense of particular styles of architecture or resent them. John Betjeman there campaigning furiously to protect Euston Arch and failed, but campaigned to save St Pancras Station. But used lots of film as a poet, as an author, using humour basically to challenge the orthodoxy opinion of the professional elite knowing best, as a way of saying we need something that's different, we need something that doesn't look like everywhere else, that something else matters. So, let's come to an end there. Stanley Clarke says that we ignore lots of things: city of memory, of desire, of spirit, of place, of art, what's been written into stone, what's been written onto memories. Those are the things that people remember and they like talking about and they want to discuss if you prompt them into discussing these things. Not the sort of syntax and language of planning and strategies and laws and property rights and so on. And so if that's the case, then there's a gap that needs to be bridged in terms of what might happen. Cinema is an ideal means, but one means, to do that bridging, to think about spatialization, to think about change, because it depicts those multiple meanings of place. Even individual film stills, you can have a conversation with different perspectives on what you're seeing there, and that's very important as well. Planning has failed to see the cities as living places of work, of homes, of interaction, because 20th century planning turned its back on questions of values, of meanings, of the arts, rather than science, of city building. And really, it was time that we engaged that more so. So, I think that, for me, it's about convincing my colleagues in planning to think about notions of place and people, rather than plans and participation. Very different sort of language altogether. It's looking at the things that we take for granted, the unwritten side of cities, because those are the things that people have a sense of attachment to, the routine, the red buses, the orange buses, and so on. And also, film provides this way of linking in into the stories to see the immediate past and how it's changed, and also learn by your mistakes. And I say to my planning students, for every intervention and every success you will have, there will be a failure. And you have to accept as a planner, you'll have both. You don't have just one, you have both of them. And so film is an obvious way to show, if you like, your mistakes, as well as demonstrate your success as well. So what we have left, really, is a series of bits of architecture, bits of the urban realm, which you might pass by, you might take for granted, or regard as routine, but actually people feel quite sensitive about, and maybe want to protect, and maybe they are iconic as well. A red bus next to neoclassical architecture in London, for example, or bits of previous planning decisions you'd rather perhaps have not made, but nevertheless they're still there as part of the landscape. This is going to be an interesting one that's going to kick off very soon. This is the remaining part of the train shed at London Bridge Station, a grade 2 star listed building which has just been approved for demolition next to and under the Shard, because it doesn't fit in to the Shard, which is an interesting way of looking at the world. So the best thing to do is to remove it, to members of the public living around there, and as part of Cameron's big society and localism agenda, the neighbourhood forum there are saying, no, we want that because we like it. It's part of our everyday scene. And the planner's response was, yeah, but you don't use it. You live next door to it. It's millions of other people use it, and we're improving it for their purpose. And you just live next to it, but you don't use it, so therefore you're disqualified from making a comment about it. So it's been given permission to be got rid of, even though, of course, it is part of the fabric, and it does date from 1860, and it is more iconic, perhaps, than the flat roof, which is going to replace it. And, of course, the city is made up of lots of different narratives, lots of different people, and it's not one set of stories, it's a mixture of stories, and that's what film does. It allows those different stories and different communities and ethnicities to be played out, even down to cobble streets, and recognising that this is obviously the north, or it's Lancashire, or it's the start of Coronation Street, or something like that, which has been going on 50-odd years. Or mundane places that people still have a use to, whether it's there or underneath bridges. So is this a place of crime, a place of fear, or a place of art? And you talk to different people and it means different things to them. But it's an important space. But you ask planners to recognise the importance of this, like under South Bank, for example, which is a more extreme version, and they fail to do so because they do not put themselves into the language and situation of the places and the people who actually use these places. So further research work is about these sorts of things. I'm still playing around with this, despite the book. I'm still playing around with these real and imagined perspectives of the place and how they cross over into real world views of the world. I think there's an increasing tendency for society to search for authenticity in the urban. And that means doing something that's different, that has a unique identity, that may be recognisable as being fixed in certain places, space and time, as opposed to the same places and same sorts of developments you find everywhere. I think those cultural references are serving as a route into a search for this authenticity and physical identity, but it's very difficult to quantify, acknowledge that. Cinematic representations can assist in us recognising and reading the urban. That's a sign I've got to finish. And also recognising people's emotion about that as well. But sometimes it crosses over into real campaigns, like protecting buildings that might have been have a starring role in films or not. The issue about spatial nostalgia and memory derived from more cultural readings and constructs and how they carried over, I think, is something that I certainly would like to take forward in my work. I've taken up a huge amount of time, so thanks very much for listening.
Thanks very much, Mark. That was really engaging and insightful. We'll open the floor to questions now, and if you want to field them yourself, but I've got one actually. I'm just wondering, in the UK context, how useful it is to sort of create a paradigm, especially in the 20th century with cinema. Because in my head, when you were talking about the North and you were talking about memory, I was thinking of the rash of films that came out in the mid-80s from low-budget producers like Letter to Brezhnev and Rita Sue and Bob 2 and My Beautiful Laundrette, and how they kind of, you know, sort of gave to that anti-Thatcherite argument by saying, look what's happening to our cities. I mean, each of those films opens with an extremely desolate view of Liverpool, of Sheffield, and of London. Yeah. And then you compare that to the 1990s and you have Notting Hill, Sliding Doors, Four Weddings and a Funeral, which present this beautiful, regenerated, whitewashed, quite literally, view of the city. Yeah. So do you think it's useful to talk about, and you mentioned Saturday Night, Sunday Morning and the sort of angry young man setting. Do you think it's useful to sort of, could you create paradigms in the UK context with regards to urban cinema?
You could look at different genres, you could look at different time periods and styles of films over time and relate them to perhaps being representative, not actual, but nevertheless representative, a hint of the real, about what was going on at the time. And if that serves as a prompt to people to think about those conditions and urban change as much as the people's lives who were suffering or whatever, then I think it's a useful thing. But you have to remember that they are fictional as well, that they are narrative in nature. What I'm arguing, basically, I suppose, is for a prompt. It's a prompt as a way of thinking about these things. that might not otherwise be registered on people's sensitivities otherwise. Notting Hill, people still search for that blue door.
If
they go around Notting Hill, they look for the door where lived.
It's not actually there anymore.
No, it's not there because the owner sold it for a vast sum of money. It's been transported somewhere else now. But people still, try and find the doors with a different colour and different design and what they photograph next to it. And it's interesting that you don't get that necessarily with those northern films.
No.
People want their, photographs taken next to industrial derelict land or anything like that. John Davis's photographs, landscape photographs of 1980s urban Britain and landscapes are absolutely fantastic. They do that as well. Where you can create, I don't know if you can create paradigms from these things, actually. I think it's more about, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of films. And each person will have a different construct of seeing the films, and even the same films between different people. You have different views. And whatever motivates yourself, whatever emotion you come away from, and whether you feel then a sense of longing or a sense of doing something about it, I think that's the important thing to recognise, not say act upon, but recognise.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other questions or comments?
I think this thing is quite interesting in relation to the idea of whether film creates false memory.
Mm.
We talk a lot about nostalgia, and this nostalgia is something that never existed.
Yeah.
This possibility of the shot in Lambeth.
Yeah.
Almost all of the examples one can use looking at a fake reality.
Mm.
And you want to say something about false memory in that respect?
Absolutely. You don't. I suppose you don't know whether to burst the bubble at some point and actually say no. Come on, shake yourself out of it and get back to the real world. Almost, you'd rather live in the filmic, a movie as much as anything else. No, I think that it leads to expectations. I think about what people expect to see. So even if the film creates false locations, it creates these false memories about a golden era which actually never was to some extent, and certainly the Ealing comedies could be accused of that to some extent, dealing with change. I think it creates expectations about what the public expects and how you think maybe the planners, developers and others will react in time, or the sorts of urban areas they expect. People, going on missions to try and find the Truman Show location, which is Seaside is an actual place in Florida, but nonetheless finding that as the utopia, as the ideal means of living, in the community. So it's interesting that maybe it's a more attractive proposition than the actual reality that planners and architects have provided for some people. But that will vary spatially, it will vary place to place as well, according to their own experience and upbringing.
Actually, I was thinking of the opposite of dystopia. For example, I don't know if you're aware of the Romanian realist movies that have been winning the Cannes, Berlin festivals. And so the image of the post-socialist city that you portray there is actually something that what people don't actually experience on an everyday basis. They portray the worst, and kind of the more alienating, terrible circumstances, just actually kind of reminding me of the post-industrial thing. But actually, I want to thank you for your lecture. It was actually very interesting. And one thing that I was thinking of is the role of film of actually responding to a certain very difficult political system. So I was thinking of 1983, in my home Romania, where a third of the city of Bucharest was laid out for demolition in order for Ceausescu to build his giant scheme. So there, and he forbid all people of taking photos or filming any of those areas that were going under demolition for the memory to disappear, and also for the demolition itself. But one filmmaker who had to make a film about a woman who was a taxi driver, about her independence, chose to make her drive. Like, the whole movie is only about her driving in those streets, and the regime kind of lost that out of control. And now, actually, in the late 2000s, this movie re-emerge, and actually planners now think, how can we actually reinvent that spirit of, spirit of the place?
Mm.
So
mm.
it's very,
I think that's really interesting. And whether it's, you know, there's an element of authoritarianism in you know, authoritarianism has used urban planning quite effectively, I'm sorry to say, over time. Hitler, of course, was a failed town planner. You know, he was. You can achieve a lot in this, and maybe then there's a reaction against it, and film can play that part. I mean, in South Africa apartheid, all the townships were designed, urban design point of view, in fan shape. And the idea was you could just put a tank there and you could control everyone in the process. And that was a typical way of using urban planning in that way. But I think that's right. I think that, you know, you could almost, in Berlin at the moment, the whole debate about whether to demolish the East German parliament and rebuild the 19th century, you know, Gothic masterpiece, is playing with those sorts of notions about the identity and issue and what we've lost, and whether it's accurate or whether it's pastiche, I think is interesting. Maybe postmodern architecture plays with those notions as well, so it's really interesting. Well, it's the same in the UK, where you know people were really enthusiastic about high-rise living in the 50s and 60s. If you compare it to the sorts of living conditions and houses that they had to deal with, and Streets in the Sky actually was an attractive proposition because it was a much better quality of life in terms of space, in terms of space of the apartments themselves, versus the hovels that they were in. So. You know, some of it was realised quite well, a lot of it wasn't realised as well as it should have been, in terms of the vision, in terms of design, and also the quality of building materials and the fabric, the urban fabric being created. But you're right, I mean, once you lose something, you essentially wipe the slate clean and you start again. The issue is, can you reconstruct it? And even if you can reconstruct it, does it bring back the sorts of imaginary memories and the memories that you thought you had? Which is difficult to identify. It does bring it back a certain building that was demolished in the 1930s in Berlin. Does that recreate Berlin for what it really stands for? Or is it the East German Parliament building that actually stands for a lot more about Berlin's identity than that does? So, you know, we have a competition, effectively, between different styles and issues. But there have been successes, and you've got to remember that this enthusiasm for the modern world, for improved conditions, is quite legitimate. And also, to some extent, planning architectural communities respond appropriately because there's a demand for it, politically, to some extent, publicly, certainly. But, of course, history will judge you. History will always judge you according to, over time, the intervention that you made. And history will judge you wrong because that's the benefit of hindsight. And we wouldn't have done it in that way. But for at that time, it was appropriate. So I also say to my students, as well as saying there'll be success and there's failures, there's never a right or a wrong. There's just an answer. And history and public and others will judge you at some point in the future. In my very first day, I used to be a planning practitioner, and then I escaped. My first week of my job, I worked in a local authority in Devon, and the first thing that my boss did was he took me in his car. We toured around the area, around the towns,
and he'd been working in the authority 25, 30 years, and he pointed out to me all his mistakes. He said, at the time, they were the right responses, appropriate responses, this is what was meant, but in reality, this is what it is today, and it causes another set of need for interventions and change, which is enduring. It's a cycle, basically. And that's the fact, isn't that there's not one moment and one response, there's a series of them, and they overlap and they change constantly, and that built into that are collective and individual notions about particular styles of architecture, particular styles of urbanism, particular styles of living, which are then responded to differentially over time as well. So it's, you're right, but there's never, it's never singular, you could say. It's never, there's a response at a certain period of time, but that will change and will be judged as well. That's not to mean to say that you shouldn't do anything in the first place. You should always do something to manage that change. But there'll be lots of people who will be ready to judge you at a certain time in the future.
Yeah, sure.
So it is not really a question, it's more like a comment. It was really interesting to listen to an academic practitioner to talk about place, because I come from a heritage background where planners, developers, architects have always this tension between heritage, and because we like to preserve, to protect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at some point we used to see this, so many of them, and just on the open. So it is very good to listen to talk about place, which is from planners'
mm-hmm.
point of view, and to listen to people about attachment sense of place and identity.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I don't know what brought this change. Is it globalization or sort of just because of change of ideologies that they really want to listen to people now?
Well, I think the issues of heritage, I think, are very interesting, because everything we see around us, even if it's brand new, will become heritage at some point. And you know, it'll be subject to having a conservation area and a listed building slapped on it, because there's clamour for it. I mean, in the UK, when conservation areas were first, listed buildings were first enacted in the 1960s, after we demolished quite a lot of the things we shouldn't have, of course, we learned by our mistake. Then the obvious places and obvious buildings were protected immediately, the iconic ones you'd expect them to, but it's increasingly become warped by its overuse. So, you know, where I live in South London, a lot of the interwar houses, 1930s houses, semi-detached houses, are now conservation areas. Not because there's any architectural historic merit necessarily in those places, but people see them as a way of protecting their property prices and adding a naught on to their price of their house as well. That's not really heritage.
Not to keep the distinctiveness and the identity of the area and the attachment to the area.
Sure.
Attachment.
Yeah. And it's happening in I was talking to a planner from Surrey this morning, who lives in Reigate, and they have a series of communities in Reigate which are essentially £1 million row houses, multi-million pound houses, and they are Victorian or Edwardian design. But they seem to be occupied by footballers' wives and girlfriends. And there's a clamour, as is happening in parts of Manchester as well, in Cheshire, where those buildings and those designs do not suit the current needs and style of those occupants. And so they are they're asking for demolition of those properties and replaced by something that you'll find out of grand designs, I should imagine. And so that's changing the character completely of that part of town. You suddenly have more modernist creations going in between lots of Edwardian and Victorian properties, because not everyone's a footballer. It's creating a lot of backlash from the rest of society and the rest of the town over what that means for them. So, okay, they might be old buildings, but perhaps they're not of a fantastic character to warrant protection, but nevertheless, they're an important part of the street scene and the townscape as well. And so people feel as though they have no control there. They can't express their feelings about what that means that's important to them, because there's no way of recognising that within the sort of planning process that we have.
Do you find it usually that difficult to balance between the two push for change and push to preserve?
Yeah, it's a contradiction. Mm-hmm. And we roll it into one system and pretend that we can have both. And of course, it will, for every winner, there's a loser that you created.
But that's the system. You know, so in the 1930s in the UK, when planning, town planning, which was proactive, urban-centric, became town and country planning, that's where it compromised. Town planning, proactive, town-centric, country planning, no development, no urban expansion, protect agriculture. Two systems rolled into one. And likewise, we put conservation and heritage issues into planning. So it looks, tries to do this balancing act as well.
I think Park Hill in Sheffield is a good example of that now. I don't know if everyone knows Park Hill. It's the archetypal streets in the sky. I think it's the largest listed building in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It's enormous. It's five stories, huge interconnected blocks. And initially, you would be able to walk right the way through from one end to the other without interruption. And all the flats face on to the, to the corridors. But they're redeveloping that now. I don't know who the company is. Urban Splash. He was talking here yesterday. And they're keeping the outer facade. So that's the heritage aspect. And then they're putting in new, whatever
they're
you want to call it.
They're keeping the structure.
Are they?
They're just keeping the box frame.
So
they're punching through it.
Right, but they're mixing the housing, aren't they, between social and private? So it's a kind of, it's a way of balancing. Yeah, because there will be social residents that had lived there before. Am I right, Otto?
Yeah.
And that are, yeah, and then bringing new people in. So it's a compromise,
yeah.
Essentially.
But then, you know, there's a danger of gentrifying.
Yeah.
So you're gentrifying,
yeah,
it in the process.
Yeah.
It's not a danger.
Well, it's a fact. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a fact.
Yeah.
Well, that's what pays for it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So
it has not had them before. It's now half and half, whatever split they've gone for.
Yeah.
Paper.
No, the Trellick Tower, which was social housing, is now it's full of professional media sets because of its iconic status, and it's it's no longer necessarily only for there's some state housing association properties in there, but it's they've been squeezed out to some extent by a professional elite, and some of the other sort of 1930s modernist buildings that they're meant to do the same thing. It's the same thing that's happened to them. So there's issues about heritage, about keeping buildings but renovating them and bringing them back to scratch, and in doing so, because of their historic architectural features, they're probably more attractive than the sorts of the new build that are going up. So immediately they attract a premium.
I guess I kind of have just a general comment as an American and as a Kentuckian, I guess, because the word Kentucky in Shawnee meant dark and bloody ground, which was supposed to only be a hunting ground. And they have a lot of theories for why Mississippian culture died out and why there was a sort of like nomadic respect for the land where there was no building by Cherokee or Shawnee or other tribes in the area, and it was solely for the purpose of hunting. And what's weird is, I guess, I start to think about the general intuition that people coming from colonial culture have. My family came from London in 1642, and I was born in Kentucky. So, there was a slow encroachment of what, when I was in Berkeley, a Native American teacher, Blackfoot teacher in philosophy, called the slow march of whiteness over the land, which, when it comes to burial mounds, we just build on top of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another kind of interesting collision between what is sacred space, because it's respecting this striation of the individuals that are dead now, that even change the form of the land, make it smooth in a way,
mm-hmm.
but it's on the basis of all these dead individuals. So even natives would pass around it as a sort of almost totally antithetical to the white idea or to the colonial idea or the industrial idea that if we have public policy and it's for the good, then we're serving all these private people and their interests. But it's fashioned by generalizations, by rules, by procedures, by law, et cetera. So I really like that you're watching the collision between this, how to mediate or how to bridge, as you say,
mm-hmm.
the private and public. But I wonder if films like Fight Club might actually be more indicative of this growing sensitivity, since here we are in Cambridge and one of the professors is or I mean, I'm sure you're a guest or whatever, but coming to a sensitivity about looking back over mistakes or nostalgia or things that public planning did a certain way or whatever, how to please the private, how to please individuals. And I wonder, you know, there are like repercussions almost for like the non-tribal, completely striated, shamanic way of navigating the world and the slow compromises that happen when you decide to live inside a building that doesn't have sunlight, that has mold, that creates a routine. And in Fight Club, I think, you know, you're in your stack and you have your yin-yang table that you ordered online and all your little amenities so that you can have everything really well regulated because you're existing in like the state and a smooth space. You're abiding by all the procedures and the rules. Yet you feel no fulfillment of your identity and you rather explode it all and live in this like little old abandoned house that's leaky. That you can build no memories in it really. You can build no family and you can not create any nostalgia in. It's the jumping point so that you could look out from a skyrise later and destroy banks. Because here, this nihilistic feeling that to start over again is true sensitivity to what the state and the apparatus of industrialism has already compromised. So it's weird because you have this antinomy of looking at, like you can really respect public planners that really have a sensitivity to wanting to do something good and make it last. But then you start to think about the native interpretation of property or of people's individual destiny across space and wonder if it's already a big compromise to be even stepping into property and patent and et cetera.
Yeah.
Just a perspective.
No, and the issue I was thinking about when you were talking was once you recognize it, can you do anything about it? You know, so once you convince planners to think about place and identity and meaning for different groups who live around there or used to live around there, there's another issue about how you enact it and what you do about it, and if you can, because that's where the property interests really come to fall there.
Yeah.
And even if you do create something to protect it in some way through planning means, it doesn't mean to say it won't will be protected, as we saw in the case of, you know, demolishing Trinity car park.
Mm.
That's why I think although it's a cop out, but that's why I like talking about to planners about having this keener sense of place, identity, and meaning. But it's still going to be a hard slog in trying to do anything about it. And whose interests do you work for anyway?
Well, I came here sort of partly hoping to find out about your own film work. Did you film when you were in your MA at film studies? Did you just get criticism and write your thesis up about architecture in film, or did you actually create or try and create?
No, I have done some film.
I don't want to belittle what you did already. It's a great achievement.
But it's mainly I stick mainly with photography rather than making films.
And you didn't bring any good photographs along.
Everything you saw just about was mine. That's what I do. That's my role behind the camera, if you like, rather than making films.
Right.
Everyone can make a film these days. You can make it on your phone this way. But no, I've always been intrigued about crossing that boundary and asking UCL for a sabbatical for 2 years to go off and make a film somewhere. It's a very attractive proposition, obviously, but you can imagine what they say in the process. And so you're in planning, why do you want to do that? So, you know, you're pigeonholed in certain disciplinary arenas anyway. But no, I walk the streets in terms of taking pictures of everything. But not to the point of making films. I comment on films and I write DVD booklet blurbs for BFI, things like that.
Right.
But not the point of making.
The second thing is because I'm a landscape painter, and so that kind of wireism that you have sort of recorded of people trying to go to the place the photograph or the film was made, they go back to pay homage to the shrine.
Yeah.
I mean, I do landscapes, and I go through Flickr, or I go through Vimeo, or I go through other kind of photographic libraries. And very often the GPS is provided, and I then go to Google Maps and all that, and try and build up a forensic portrait of it and think, is it worth going to?
Yeah.
I think that it's that sort of fetishism, or that voyeurism, or that need to make it credible that you see an image and that image exists, and you want to find out more about it from your own from your own space. It's quite an interesting one.
Yeah, a sense of realism, bringing it to life.
Bringing it to life, and it happens with the natural landscape,
yeah.
As well as the man-made one.
And it works on two levels. It works on that in terms of crossover between something you see on screen or on paper and actually going and visiting the place. It also works in this sort of fetish, I suppose, for then and now as well, in terms of going back and looking at historic photographs and trying to replicate the exact perspective again and see how much has changed. There's a whole industry, the publishers have produced scores and scores of books which play mainly perhaps to older generations who are interested in how things have changed and how things used to be as well.
I'm
in that bracket as well.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed that.
I think there's also a tourism of people that go around bridging what's then and what's now by watching that change. So the demolition of multi-stories is in 20 seconds, you're going from then to now. And it's really startling. I mean, when you see buildings like in Glasgow being blown up, and it's really like when you take it in, it's hard to take in.
Mm.
All of a sudden, it's gone. And they implode within like 5 seconds. And you're like, wow. And usually now, people put them on YouTube and catch them on film. So you can relive that moment over and over and over again.
Delight.
And you're like, I can't
delight.
Believe this is gone.
Yeah. Well, it's not so much that the building is gone that maybe you're used to or you resent it in some way,
mm-hmm.
but actually it's the space that's left.
Mm-hmm.
That it creates new perspectives and places behind the building that you couldn't otherwise have seen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even in London at the moment, the Crossrail being built around Tottenham Court Road, around Oxford Street, Centre Point, you saw new perspectives
mm-hmm.
of the city you think you know very well, partly because some major blocks of building had been demolished, creating very much new urban perspectives. It's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating to see those historical layers of intervention as well.
Mm. Does anyone else have any more questions or comments? Two more, yeah. Do you want to go?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just ask, is something significant or unique about urban planning is a sense of permanency? So you're looking at a longer duration and process. Because I'm coming from the angle of cultural encounters in urban settings. And with migration and immigration, the changes are so quick. People can learn languages easily. People can take up different clothing and dress. But to change a landscape and urban environment, that's something that we are seeing taking place at a slower rate. And slightly related to sort of capturing that idealized authenticity. You don't want to have this sort of change happening at a quick of a rate.
Yeah, I actually think that used to be the case. We used to have buildings and interventions that lasted long periods of time. It was amazing, actually, certainly in the UK, in our cities, historic buildings, as they would now be labelled, that lasted two world wars. Well into the 1950s and 1960s, but it was the decisions of local authorities and planners and others who chose to, maybe influenced by the market, obviously, that chose to get rid of them rather than war. But I think the pace of change, a turbulence, is actually speeding up in some places, and certainly in world cities, the pace, the recycling of sites with different types of developments is actually speeding up. Permission has just been given for Broad Street next to Liverpool Street Station to be demolished. And it was only finished in 1989. And that's how quick, if you go into the City of London, buildings on a 20 to 25 years cycle. And the City of London is absolutely amazing because it has this 1,000-year history or more as well, but there are bits of it which are historic and bits of it which are very new. And the question is, will the new survive as long as the older bits? And my guess is it won't. Quite deliberately so, partly because of the advances of technology and energy efficiency in buildings, and so that's the reason why some of the buildings are going, or because of poor quality of building material at the time. But also cachet, a certain sexiness associated with getting a brand new spanking building to represent your bank or insurance company in the sexiest city in the world, that's more iconic than something that looks as though it's dated from the 1970s or 1980s. So I think actually things are speeding up, but the pace of change will differ in different places, and some places will be slower
in some places it'll be much faster depending on what the conditions are.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up there just now. Sorry to get your question. We're going to hang around for a bit and then we're going to head over to the Granton. Feel free to come along. If you don't know anyone, introduce yourself and come with us. Next week we've got Professor Ash Amin, who's Professor of Geography. And what's he? Telescopic orbits. It's not a sign. Anyway, thanks very much, Mark. That was really interesting. So.